You're listening to What the Sass, the Future of FinTech, a podcast hosted by Paul Josephak, the CEO and co-founder of Receive. On the show, Paul speaks with industry leaders and experts on the many topics surrounding digitalization, innovation, and the future of FinTech. We'll share ideas and solutions that can help companies and their customers get the best experience possible and help them win back the modern world of finance. So let's jump into the show. Paul, take it away.
Okay. Hi, everyone. I'm actually here today with Miriam. I'll let her introduce herself because I could say Miriam from RatePay, Miriam from Banksware. Miriam, as everyone knows, Miriam in the fintech world in Germany. I highly doubt anyone listening to this probably doesn't know who she is. But why don't we do that first? Why don't you tell us who you are so I don't introduce you the wrong way. And then we can kick off.
Hello. Thanks a lot for inviting me. Hi, Paul. Nice to see and hear you again. At least we see ourselves virtually. Yeah, hopefully soon again in person. Yeah, so I'm Miriam Wolfhardt. I'm in the, let's say, fintech space, a digital payment space since more than 20 years. I'm a bit of a payment nerd and banking nerd. However, I founded RatePay. That is now actually turns this year. It's going to be 12 years ago in December. Wow. So it's a long ride, a long journey. I was their managing director. I'm still managing director, but I'm not really in an operational role anymore. So I'm slightly phasing out there. I also founded Banksware. This was just recently. I co-founded it with others. That was last year in September. Maybe we talk later what these companies are doing. Besides to these, let's say, companies, I'm also partner of payment and banking, which I really love, which was a kind of, let's say, hobby project that turned into a small company with really a mission and passion. And it's also,
I see it all over the place, right? So, I mean, you guys have kind of established yourselves as one of the events. I mean, it's events, it's podcasts, it's a website. Yeah. There's all kinds of things, right?
Yeah, we can talk about this also later. So about the industry, because it started all with ideas, because we were a group of people interested in the fintech space. And actually this year, payment and banking is going to be 10 years old. This week, it's going to be 10 weeks.
Wow, 10 years old. Wow.
Yeah. It's a long journey. So it's about dinosaurs in the industry. Yeah. And I'm super interested also in startups and startup teams, which I'm also in the board of Startup Teens, which is a foundation for young people in order to get in touch with entrepreneurship and mm-hmm. founding companies and also, let's say, digital education. So, yeah, some hard issues like digital education, startups, and so on. Yeah, for myself, I live in Berlin. I'm not a Berlinian, but actually, I'm here since 8 years. I like it very much. And very nice to be here. And also, we know each other also since a long time because we came across in the Otto Group.
It's kind of funny how so many paths lead back to Otto somehow. One of our previous guests also happened to work at Otto way back when, and I kind of forgot that I knew he was there, but it kind of came up in a conversation. It was like, oh yeah, that's right. You were at Otto as well. It's a small world when you kind of think about it. And I don't even know. Did we actually meet before Otto? I mean, we kind of, obviously we were working together, but I could have sworn I met you kind of in some capacity in the Berlin startup scene, but you said you've only been in Berlin for 8 years.
18.
Okay, now then that all comes back because I was about to say, I was like, 8 years doesn't sound right. I feel
Coming
across here probably in the early
2000s. Yeah. No, it's 18 years.
Now I feel even older because I've been in this industry here since 97. So I'm pushing 24 years now in kind of this world. And I was back in Berlin and even in the 90s where, I've seen it change. So, yeah, what were you actually doing before? I mean, again, let's not make this boring. What were you doing before you kind of went to Berlin? I mean, did you study in Berlin and then stayed, or what's
no,
the backstory?
No, actually, my CV is a bit funny, to be honest. When I studied actually in Tübingen, which is a small town in the south of Germany. I studied politics, economy, and English, but I didn't finish that study, so I quit more or less, and I traveled a lot. And then I went into the travel industry. I didn't I did a traineeship there in the travel industry and stayed there for a while. And that's the reason why so I stayed there until the year 2000, and then I moved into the digital industry. Yeah.
Wow, okay. So you completely lateraled into a new role.
Yes, because in 1999, when I was in the travel industry, there was super many changes because in Germany at that time, and probably for some people today, you know, that were born in the, let's say, 90s or so, or the end 90s, they don't really know where we booked, how we booked flight tickets in the 90s. Yeah, sure. So there was no internet to book the flights.
You don't even know about holding an actual ticket when you go up and check in, right?
Yeah.
I miss them.
So this was one of the biggest challenges in the travel industry at the, let's say, end of the 90s, beginning of the 2000s. How do we get the bookings in the internet? And actually, the company I worked for this day were also working on these issues. And so I met a small startup at that time in 2000, which was called Bibit Global Payment Services. And the name Bibit, nobody knows it anymore. But if you Google it, you realize that the founders of Bibit are also the founders of Adyen. So this is actually how I came in this industry. I met them and I got stuck in the industry, and I like it since then. Yeah.
Cool. Also kind of a question, since you've now also been in Berlin for 18 years, I mean, what's your take on having seen the change? Because I mean, Berlin's gone through so many changes. I mean, I was there even in the early 90s, right? So I kind of saw right after the wall came down a couple of years with one of my first companies. And then I was there, you know, primarily as an investor in the late 90s. So starting in 97, it was basically a wasteland when it comes to startups. I mean, it just started kind of ramping up in the late 90s. And then I guess if you came there after 2000, what's your kind of take? I mean, how has Berlin evolved? Has it been fast, or has it been just the last couple of years, or have you seen waves? What's your take on it?
Actually, it was the last couple of years. I would say after about, like, let's say 13, 14 before this, actually it was, I didn't think it didn't have so many startups. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Because in the years, but what happened actually, you know, when I moved here in 2002, it's 19 years ago, it's 2002. So actually I moved here because my husband, at that time, he started working at eBay. And probably at that time in 2002, there were not really many jobs here in Berlin, and there were not many internet companies.
Isn't eBay outside of town? They were somewhere.
They're still there. They're in Dreilinden. They're outside. So if you drive, you have to go to, it's actually in Brandenburg. So probably they had quite some cheap land there where they could build a nice building outside of the city. So a kind of campus. And it's a super nice office. So at that time, this office was really, really cool. So today you would say, it's a nice office, but it's still nice. But at that time, it was super cool.
Which was new back then.
So I actually, he went to Berlin in order to work here. And I started, at that time, I worked actually for this Dutch company, Bibit. And I more or less, I traveled a lot. So I stayed many times. I was in the Netherlands because they were based in the Netherlands. I was able to work from home office even at that time. So I'm used to working in home office since a long, long time. So we moved here but I was always, I was always thinking, what is, if I don't like this job anymore, could I ever find a job in Berlin? Because at that time, the startup scene was not there yet. And I would say the unemployment rate in Berlin was super, super high. So, then it started, then we had these initiatives actually from a lot of ex-eBay people started building up own companies. Mm-hmm. And also we had like people around, Lukas Gadowski, who was founding like Spreadshirt. Yep. And then internet, this all started erupting suddenly. And also
it was Lukas, then he pulled in like Jan Beckers, and then kind of the Zumvers came at some point. But I mean, Oliver Besta, someone who we both also know. There was a couple of people and everyone knew everyone, right? I mean, back in
So they knew each other, but probably one of the, let's say, strongest engines for the city was probably Zumvers. Yeah, we have to admit that, even if we don't always like them.
Oh yeah.
But I mean,
I just a funny anecdote on that. I wrote an answer on Quora. If everyone remembers Quora, I mean, I'm now dating myself there because I feel like that's like 10 years old. And someone had asked me to answer a question about the Zumvers and what I thought about the Zumvers. And I've known those guys since the 90s. I mean, I know Mark probably best, but I actually wrote that they were one of the best things that could have happened to the German startup scene, because Rocket Internet, we can all think, as you said, what we will of their practices, but it was one of the best schools for founders.
Absolutely.
How many companies have been started by former Rocket guys now or women? So it's wild. I mean, if they hadn't shown up in Berlin, I don't think Berlin would have been on the map.
So. Yes, I think so too. So this was really actually the one that was the catalysator actually that brought it all up more or less. So it was the combination of eBay being here, because I mean, eBay was also, if people that don't know the story of eBay, eBay was once called Alando, actually. Yeah. Alando was a small, let's say, marketplace, and that was actually founded by the Sumber brothers. And this Alando
after Ali came back from San Francisco, where he saw and he decided to copy it one-to-one to make sure he could sell it to him, right?
Yeah, and this was actually, that was, I think it was around 99 or 98 or so, yeah. And then actually eBay bought it.
6 months after and, founding.
Yes, and they stepped out, and then, you know, then I remember, you know, then they did this this ringtone company that...
Jamba,
yeah, right, it was Jamba. And then they founded Zalando, which was actually... let's say the rebirth of Alando and the set for Zappos, because Zappos at that time in the US was also the role model for this. So it's interesting to see how this all worked. And then suddenly, I think around, let's say 13, it started, you know, that new companies were starting up. And also the magazine started, like Deutsche Startups, Inkundazine, and so on. And this was also...
There was a sort of issue, but there was it was so the Rocket guys were one of the things that I found probably one of the biggest quasi benefactors for Berlin. But then there was, I mean, you mentioned Lukasz Kadowski. They started Team Europe, which kind of in its own way led to a ton of. I mean, it was a microcosm. Yeah. It was smaller than Rocket, but I think Team Europe did a big push. Then one of the other people that I think is very underrated for Berlin is Christoph Mayer. So Christoph Mayer was one of the first guys who was doing a bunch of angel investments way back. I mean, he was a Gate 5 guy. I actually looked at Gate 5 in like, I think 99 or 2000. I can't even remember when they were. And he was the French CFO of the company. And then he became one of the anchor investors as an angel in Berlin. And it's really funny how it was so few people. And then all of a sudden, this huge wave basically came after like 2010. And that's when all the companies showed up, right? I mean, that's basically...
Yeah, it was quite amazing. And then also, I mean, the evolution of fintech. So probably the first time I ever heard the word fintech was also around 2000, maybe 13 or so, or 12. So, you know, I was always working in payment. So but it was not really at that time, payment was not a sexy industry. It was something nobody really was interested in this, to be honest. Yeah, they were all saying, okay, payment is the end of the, let's say, yeah, you need to have it, but it's something that is not so great. It's not sexy. It's not cool. And so, but I mean, when you now see the rise of payment companies in the world, it has gotten a totally different reputation now.
Money makes sexy, right? Once you sell a couple of companies for a couple of billion.
Let's be honest. Absolutely.
It's not really sexy. It's not the movie industry, but.
No, absolutely not. But you know, as soon as I realized that actually, then I was at that time, you know, RatePay was already a couple of years old, but we were always operating, let's say, well, for those of you that don't know what RatePay is doing, RatePay it's a pay later company, more or less. We offer payment per invoice and payment via installment and direct debit with a payment guarantee to merchants. But the differentiation, let's say, to Klarna is that it is white label. It is not a brand. So it's always in the look and feel of the merchant. So a customer always feels as if the customer pays at the shop with invoice or with Lastschrift or with Kartenzahlung. Mm-hmm. So we at that time chose a different way to go than Klarna, because it was also a matter of funding. Yes, I mean, if when we compared what our funding was compared to the Klarna funding, we had not really a choice really to build up a brand, and so we decided to go white label, which was a really good decision, I would say. Yeah. Today, RatePay is quite successful, and I would say in Europe probably within the white label companies we are together with Arvato. The market leader, so that is it was a great journey. And
when was RatePay actually came, like when did you start RatePay?
It was in 2009 actually. So we were three founders, but at that time we had no idea how to build a company. We are more or less from the industry, we knew the market, and But then also Oliver Bester helped us as a kind of, let's say, angel. It was more like an angel. He got, you know, he got some shares of the company and he really helped us with the investment. Mm-hmm. And so in 2009, you know, it was hit very hard by financial crisis. Mm-hmm. It was not really the best thing actually to build a financial company because nobody wanted to invest in it. Yeah. So it was difficult to get investment and we didn't receive any VC capital. And so we actually, but we were happy that we actually found the Otto Group as strategic investor. So,
yeah, I mean, it was, that was still, you know, 2009, 2010, again, everyone was burned by the 2008 crisis. Yeah. People and I mean, European investors had no clue. They did not understand payment or fintechs at all.
No.
It was almost taboo, right?
Yeah, it was almost a taboo. People thought we were crazy that we're doing this, but okay. Well, it worked out really fine. See, I was always super excited about the product, and I was 100% sure that it will work because there was so much demand for a cool solution for payment upon invoice that can be integrated really in an online experience. Because at that time it was not digital, you know, these solutions that were there and they were not combined. So yeah, and there was demand and. Lucky shot, it worked out. So quite happy that it worked out. But then, yeah, actually, I was talking about something else because coming back to the origin where I was saying that fintech was born, you know, and because I realized probably 2013 that we do fintech. And I remember saying to my co-managing director, Jesper, we stayed together. You know him well as well, Jesper Barndorf. He's now at Vanguard. And we worked together for 9 years. And I remember me saying to Jesper, yes, but you know, there is always this fintech. There's always these things now going around fintech. And when I look at this, because payment and banking at that time already, they had these kind of, let's say, mind maps. Okay, what is fintech? And I said, okay, payment is also fintech. Mm-hmm. And I said to them, you know what? We call ourselves now also a fintech company. That helps maybe to, let's say, position ourselves more, get more market, get more press and things like this, because it was really difficult to get awareness in the industry, let's say, in marketing. And so we said, okay, we are fintech.
I think it'll
and that really helped.
Yeah, it took a little bit of time, but I think you guys got really pretty well positioned. And I mean, if I think about it, RatePay is at least a couple hundred people now, right? If not.
Oh, it's 280.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, so it got pretty big, if I remember. I mean, the reason, you know, RatePay was this weird thing when I came into the Otto Group. You guys were already there and it ended up somehow falling in my department, but I had very little to actually do with you guys because you guys were always kind of on the fringe of Otto, which I think was probably very smart in the sense that, you know, even with us, with Liquid Labs, we were trying to build things outside of the kind of the walls of the corporate. You guys had the benefit, I think, for quite some time of just, I mean, it was always in Berlin, right? I mean, you never.
It was always in Berlin and probably at the beginning, it was a rather small investment for the Otto Group. So it was not, you know, like a little bit. They were some years later, they were also invested into Yapital. And these were huge investments. That's also where they put, really, let's say, the focus on these things where they put a lot of money.
Remind me of Yapital, man. What a mess.
You know, and then we were always under the radar because we were small and we were always, you know, Jesper and me, we didn't spend much money. We were always really careful that we don't spend too much money. Yeah, that it's everything is working out smooth. That we make our numbers. That we like, let's say that we can do what we want. That was our most important thing. Yeah. That we have our freedom, and that's helped a lot. Yeah.
Yeah. No, me and Michael and I did the exact same thing. We liked our freedom. We were willing to make some compromises for the freedom that we had. And I do have to say, I mean, hats off to the Otto Group for letting you guys, letting us with Liquid Labs, kind of run in parallel.
Absolutely, yeah.
And I'm one of the people, you know, some people are kind of like, are you kind of, I don't want to say upset, or are, you know, people are like, how do you look back on your time at Otto? And if I think about Otto, I mean, when I joined them in 2012, I mean, if you had asked me a year or two before that, if I'd ever worked for Otto, I would have been like, are you trying to insult me? I'm never going to go work for Otto. But in hindsight, if you look at everything they did, they had RatePay, they let us kind of build Liquid Labs, they had Project A, they have eVenture. I mean, the amount of things that they've done over the years, I think they're so underestimated. I mean, I sound like a cheerleader, but that's not really what I'm trying to do. I'm just saying that, you know, they've actually, for the fact that they're a corporate, they've been pretty innovative and a lot
absolutely
of worked out well. I mean, and look at what's happening now with About You. I mean, About You is a, you know, almost a home run, right? So
No, it's super. That's great. And I also think that they are underestimated. I like the culture of them. I really like them. And I think it was also a smart move. I mean, in 2017, Otto sold us to private equity. Yeah. That was a very, very smart move because at that time, to be honest, it is not the core business of a fashion retailer to have payments companies, and especially when they grow and they need to go international and they have to do so many things, it's much better.
Yep.
So I think they had a lot of smart investments. And also I still have very good relationships with the people there.
Sure. I mean,
I really like them.
It's a long time. I think, you know, I spent almost 7 years there. You were probably working with them longer, right? So
I
never thought I'd survive more than 2 years. I mean, I am a corporate guy. So hats off to them for tolerating me for so long.
Yeah, but no, I really met great people there. And I think it was a really a good, let's say, because I was also asked many times, would it have been better with a VC or so? Yeah, you never know. I mean, what would have happened if we would have had the same funding like Klarna had? Yeah, I don't know. You never know. But I think this is their own story and this is our own story. And I think RatePay became quite successful. And also, to be honest, I mean, I think it was also quite helpful also sometimes with a corporate because they gave us more also, I think they gave us at some point maybe more time to, because they realized that it's a lot about processes and payment, that you can't really execute that fast because you have to get these processes done because you cannot go in the payment space, you cannot go out with an MVP, which is not reliable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it's a real time. It's a real time, let's say, thing in a shop. And there actually cannot really have these kind of mistakes. Yeah,
of course.
With banks where today with an MVP, we can do more mistakes in the beginning. Yeah, it's different because it's not in the, let's say, with the payment process at the end of an often shopping process, you are the way the beating heart of the shop. Yeah? when the heart stops pumping, I mean, and nothing happens, it's horrible.
Yep.
As where today, when we, you know, when there's a loan application, if there would be a little problem with, let's say, the loan is not going through, yes, that's not nice, but this is not such a big deal.
Let's use that as a segue, because I think that both with what you're doing with Banksware and what we're doing with Receive, I think you just kind of touched upon that, you know, we're taking core or near core processes and almost letting, you know, large enterprises outsource that to domain experts and kind of people who know how to do it better. I mean, so what is Banksware? What was the impetus for launching Banksware, and why did you decide to go in that direction after RatePay?
Yeah. Okay. Actually, you know, why we came there, it was more or less, I was always very driven by customers. You know, what you receive, let's say, customer feedback, you see what they want. And actually at RatePay, I received from some of our customers some feedback, especially from the marketplaces, that they said, hey, could you as RatePay offer us more liquidity for the merchants on our marketplaces because they have difficulties to get fast liquidity. They need cash to grow. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I said, yeah, okay, that's nice. Yeah. But RatePay's business is focused. It's actually a B2B2C and we do payments with the consumers. And in that case that you want liquidity for the merchants, we cannot offer this because you would have to build up a risk scoring for merchants. And this is, it would be a different thing that we do at RatePay. And suddenly I had this in my head, you know, then I was late, let's say, searching, how does a merchant get liquidity? How easy is it? How fast is it? What do you need to get liquidity? And I realized in order to get a normal loan with a bank in Germany, you need to be 2 years at least or older. You need a history. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You need many things. Sure. So this is a huge hurdle. So imagine you are a successful online merchant, just started up last year during Corona. Business is scaling hugely. You would not get a loan through a normal bank. So there are some sources of factoring, or there's some external, let's say, marketplaces, but still it takes a long time. It's not that you get this instantly. And sometimes the instant is really, really something that, you know, If you can make a lot of, let's say, turnover tomorrow by having a campaign tomorrow and paying this campaign in your marketplace or whatever, if you can buy yourself revenue, yeah? But if you don't have the money to buy the revenue, you don't make the revenue. So you need the cash fast. And then I realized in the US, you have these kind of things with Square Capital, Stripe Capital. So a lot of the payments companies, they started building up capital.
Launched
Shopify Capital, yeah. So they started launching capital companies in order to do merchant financing, revenue-based financing. So this is super smart. And I haven't seen something like this in the European market. So I was looking around. I saw that there is in the UK, you have few smaller ones, but not in mainland Europe, there was nothing. This was actually the time when I met Jens at Money 2020 in 2019. So it was just before Corona. Yeah. Jens and me were just talking about this, and I said, you know, there is huge demand coming in the market, and I don't know, there is nobody that does it. And he said, yeah, actually, you know, I see that in the US as well, and also he sees that, you know, he was working as a lawyer for different banks and different fintechs, that there's also demand. So we started talking and talking, and from this talking, suddenly we said, you know, actually, that would be interesting to do something. And then I said to him, you know, my lessons learned at RatePay, never. I would never build a company without a lawyer, because I had learned so many things in payment in a regulated environment, you know, that we spend so much money at RatePay for lawyers. And I thought I told him, you know, okay, if you are a lawyer, that's fine. You know, all the regulatory frameworks, and then I think it could really help. So we decided to do that together. But then we said, okay, listen, two of us, we cannot build it, because we are not really, let's say, we are not technical people. And so then we also got two colleagues on board, one who does the product, one from risk. And also we worked at the beginning with a software agency to get, let's say, a first demo live. And then we hired a CTO who's coming actually from Klarna. So also, there's a lot of, let's say, knowledge on instant credit decision. And what we did now is basically a solution that does instant revenue-based financing. So, and we can be integrated into any kind of platform or marketplace. I hope that was not too long.
And that's fine. I mean, that's the whole point, is to make sure we understand it. I mean, who's your target customer? I mean, who are you going after? Marketplaces primarily, or?
Yeah, marketplaces, but also payment providers. Okay. Yeah. So all kinds of platforms that have a huge marketplace, a huge merchant base, mm-hmm. and they want to offer better services to their merchant. They want to help them to get better liquidity, but also they can help them to grow with, you know, it's also, for example, if we would now think about a marketplace like, I don't know, Zalando, for example, you know, if they offer this, they could also give their merchants cash, yeah, in a way that they can book, you know, they want to be in a let's say higher ranking, whatever. Mm-hmm. So they can also, this money could also use for something like this. Yeah. So the financing that we do, it's not related to a certain kind of, let's say, invoice, or you can use the money for everything. So it's a bit like cash.
Okay. Makes sense. I mean, wouldn't that be though, kind of the business, like you mentioned, you know, Stripe and the players in the US that are doing something similar. Wouldn't that ultimately be something that potentially here in Europe, a Klarna or a RatePay would also start offering? I mean, isn't anything like your competitors?
It looks really, let's say, that was also the thing, you know, and because they asked us at RatePay, but what I learned at RatePay is, like, you know, heading a company, a technology company, where we have, let's say, 100 people in IT and engineering. That are so, I mean, our IT roadmap is so full. Probably every company that is super successful has a very, very full IT roadmap.
Sure.
So you have to think about focus. And so at the moment, the RatePay focus absolutely is not that we do B2B2B.
Sure.
And for, let's say, if to build up a good B2B scoring, you have to build up a new kind of engine.
Yeah.
And this is also, that's also the question. Would Klarna be interested in building up a completely new business model?
Oh, no.
where they have the moment, they focus on growing in different markets with their core business. And so I think it's about, and this is all what we talk about excellence at the beginning. I think the future is much more on excellence in the niche. Because it's not possible to have a general excellence anymore. This is not possible in my perception. Yeah.
Agreed.
And so I'm not, RatePay is not able to do it.
You're almost teeing up all my questions. I mean, ultimately, you guys are part of banking as a service, right? I mean,
yes.
There's a whole new way of banking as a service. We have, you know, we had the software as a service wave over the last 10 years.
Yeah.
And now it seems to me that banking as a service is kind of the next wave for the next 10 years. And there's actually, I'll have to send you this at some point because you'll probably love this article. There's an investor, Gil, I always forget his last name. He used to be at Index. Now he has a fund called Angular Ventures. And he actually wrote this podcast, blog post about a year and a half ago, where he's calling these things called like systems of intelligence. And he's basically saying that the moat for like the technology moat for a lot of the new players that are out there, kind of like you guys and us as well, is that being a domain expert is probably one of the bigger differentiators than the actual technology itself, right? Because it's all being commoditized anyway. Everyone who talks about AI, you know, at some point AI is just a commodity. It's something you plug in. It's just a feature. What's your take in general kind of on this whole banking as a service space? I mean, where's that going? Have you been talking about it? I mean, it seems like we're just kicking off, or is it?
I think it is just kicking off, especially, I mean, actually through PSD2, we got the rails, that makes something new possible. So, and I would say now, okay, PSD2 is there now since a couple of years, but now it starts that you have really the use cases on PSD2. This hasn't been there at the beginning. So there were some companies that had ideas, but not really the use cases. And also banks were, I mean, the credit decision that we do today would not be possible without a, let's say, account without an account check. So without PSD2, it would have been difficult to build something like this. And So I see much more, let's say, new kind of, let's say, use cases around PSD2, new applications. And therefore, I would think, so if we think about, let's say, platforms and where does it all go to, I think you will have in the future a lot of, let's say, niches where you have a really customer-centric product that is really, let's say, with all the relevant things a certain group needs. For example, I mean, if we look at some younger people, probably we will have portals where we see students, and then you have money for students. Like, you know, there's Deine Studienfinanzierung in Germany. You have more niche players that have not been there. And I think there is a huge market for this. And I don't see this generalistic approach so much anymore because the world is getting too complex. And it's the same with, if you look at leadership, I mean, there is not this one leader that knows everything anymore. This is just not there. It's not possible.
You have to almost be a specialist, even as I as a CEO, I have a very specific vertical of what my strengths are, and I have to hire to make sure that I have complementary skill sets around me, right? I mean,
absolutely.
And this is probably the best at everything.
I strongly believe in this future, however you call it, if you call it banking as a service, contextual banking, embedded finance, actually it's all one. It is something offering the banking services around the customer needs.
What's the regulatory environment, though? You said that a lot of regulatory changes led to quasi banking as a service or embedded finance. How's the environment today? Is there a lot of changes that still need to happen to make it smoother? Or what's your thinking there?
See, at the moment, I don't see so many hurdles there at the moment. It's not so much the regulatory framework that makes it so difficult. Okay. I wouldn't say that. But the only thing that is probably in some things that would be necessary is a kind of, let's say, rethinking the, let's say, data protection laws.
Sure.
Because this is something that's the only thing, but this is not so much the financial regulation. It is more or less the, let's say, on the consumer side. Yeah, it's more, I think it's all over Europe. Actually, we would need to establish more, let's say, possibilities to share data. And when we are able to have these shared data pools for some certain industry or so, we can build much better products. This is one of the biggest actually issues that I would see as in where do we have problems. It's not the BaFin itself. I mean, yes, it is, sometimes it's a pain, and you have to do all these things, but still
they're preoccupied with Wirecard for a while.
But this is nothing that really, I would say that it's not so much that they really are the problem for innovation.
Sure. Okay. Then you also mentioned that at a Europe level. I mean, is banking as a service, embedded finance, is the U.S. still further along? I mean, is it still the situation that the Americans or at least the U.S. market is further along, or is Asia just as far as along? I mean, is Europe kind of in parallel, quasi just as fast? What do you think?
Difficult question. Yeah, you know, I was also thinking about banks where, okay, what would we do if we would like to go to the American market or so? Would that be interesting for us? At the moment, it's not our focus, but it could be, because I think we are not so much in Europe, but at least in this issue, I don't have the feeling that we are so much behind.
Yeah.
It's more or less on the same level. So I would not say that we are in Europe much behind. Asia is different.
Yeah.
But Asia is therefore so different because, and this is also probably when you see these, you know, these super big ecosystems like WeChat and Alibaba. Sure. I mean, this is more or less actually what we are building with platforms. Actually, they are a huge platform where they have integrated every single use case of a financial banking service, whatever. Sure. But this is because they can share all the data, and this is a big problem.
And scoring.
Also this, yes, with the scoring, with the social scoring and all these kind of things. Yeah, and this is just, but it could be interesting to see how data protection laws will change.
Mm-hmm.
This is something that we have to watch, and there I see also a big chance for Europe.
Sure. I mean, that's where, again, you guys are doing the embedded finance. We're technically on the fringe of it, even with collections, right? I mean, at the end of the day, if we had data pools, you could just optimize for the end customer. So the B2B2C relationship, for example, or even in B2B collections, if you could basically share information via data pools, that would obviously optimize it for even the person who is in a tough situation, i.e. knowing how someone else resolved that situation would make it much more complimentary for everyone else. I'm presuming the same thing with you guys in terms of giving out loans and being able to score at a far, far deeper level would actually make the process smoother, would make it faster, would make it probably even more fair. Let's be honest. I mean, it's at some point there has to be a certain fairness level. And if you could pool the data, that might even actually drive it in that direction. Let me ask you another question. Where is this industry going in the next 3 to 5 years? I mean, where is, you know, with Banksware, what we're doing, you know, we're all really close kind of to the ground on all these embedded quasi domain experts. Where do we see ourselves in a couple of years? Is it going to be a highly fragmented market of vertical experts for each specific thing we do? Or is there going to be consolidation in 3 to 5 years? What do you think?
I mean, it could be that in 5 years that you have maybe more services combined, that you will see a consolidation. At the moment, I don't see consolidation, not in these fragmented services.
Sure.
So at the moment, they are rising companies. I mean, you just, congratulations, you just announced a new funding. I just saw that yesterday. Cool, so that's super. So this is also for you a great thing now to grow much, much bigger and faster, yeah?
So sure, I mean, we're going after something that used to be kind of an afterthought, and we're now putting it front and center and telling people, look, you need to think about collections before you need to think about collections. That's one of the things that we're driving. We're having this conversation over and over that you know, when it comes to the collection space, I mean, people don't realize how much value you can get out of it. And they unfortunately think about it usually too late. And it is what it is, you know?
What I see like in the next, let's say 3 years or so, I would say that we have more of these. I mean, in the past years in fintech, it was fintechs against banks. So let's say building the huge thing, you know, killing banks and so on. I don't see this anymore. So this is a new era now. I think the era now is it's fintech cooperating with banks and a changing role of banks. And this will probably, let's say, if we then look further in the future, maybe more banks will buy fintechs. Could also be that they, because they realize they need these services in order to make their customers happier, and they're not able to build them by themselves, or it's stronger corporations.
They're going to invest more. I mean, you already see it now. I mean, I think yesterday they just announced the newest investment, Upvest, which was ABN AMRO, basically coming in. I, you know, I'm seeing a lot of these banks having actual fairly active venture arms. And I think right now they're placing their bets, and then ultimately down the road, the ones who are pretty smart will probably go and buy a lot of these fintechs. I mean, I don't think they have a choice.
And, no, they have to do that.
Yeah. And I think what you're doing for what we're doing, the scale is where it's interesting, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And this is the same thing, because in the past, a bank was a generalist as well. Yeah. They tried to do everything by themselves, but technology, every company in the future has to be a technology-driven company. And usually banks, they have so much legacy. They don't have the power to build a lot of innovation.
Sure.
And I see it already in, I mean, RatePay is now, it's 12 years old, and RatePay is also regulated. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You have a lot of, let's say, issues as a regulated financial institution. It is getting much more difficult to build innovation. Yeah. Because you need so many developers. You need
Other problems is that these large banks, I mean, it's a little bit kind of like, even if you think about Otto, when we were both there, it's really hard to recruit into certain types of businesses, right? I mean, a hardcore tech person isn't looking first and foremost to go and join a bank.
No.
So
absolutely.
And I think that's the wave that fintech has been very successful with, in the sense that it's been able to make it exciting. I mean, we talked about the word sexy in connection with payments.
Yeah.
I mean, listen to me trying to make collections sound sexy. I mean, that's the biggest challenge. Payment. But it's still you can tell when recruiting, especially for technical people. But even now, I mean, even if you think about it more on the business side, be it sales, be it implementation, be it product, you know, people are finally kind of waking up to these industries, be it payments or collections or whatever else is in this kind of fintech space. But versus a bank, or versus, you know, a large retail group, or versus insurance companies, and I think everyone's struggling. You know, I mean, it's. It's still, I think the fintechs probably have the benefit for a good 5-10 years still to go, right? Fear is how much is things going to probably like fall apart? Do you still have these big players like a Deutsche Bank or a Commerzbank, or, you know, they're all fragmented anyway when you look at their geographical quasi footprint. Yeah. Will probably some of these fintechs actually grow? You know, look at an N26. You know, it's big enough. I mean, you can think what you will, or a Solaris Bank, or you know, whoever you want to use. I mean, they might just get big enough where they can't be bought and they can start competing.
Yeah. So yeah.
That's also.
Yeah, you will have a totally changed landscape in 10 years, I would say.
Yeah.
From now. More. Yeah. So there are not many banks actually that are still there, classical banks.
Yeah, I think it's going to get smaller and smaller. There might become some, you know, there's some of those players that are just big by history or by historical, you know, quasi expansion. And also by having bought a lot of players, but I mean, I'm already starting to see some of these larger players selling certain country subsidiaries, you know, back to local players and moving out of specific geographies. So
yeah.
I think that's the case. I think there is going to be some roll-ups on the fintech side. I'm pretty convinced that there will be in the next 3 to 5 years, some kind of a consolidation. We're going through an uncoupling phase right now. If you think about it, what was it? Maybe 5 years ago, everyone was talking about uncoupling what's basically G Suite. So all of a sudden you had these like individual email providers, and you have individual, I mean, even what like the, what's his name? Christian, the guys from Wunderlist who are now doing, doing their own PowerPoint quasi, like a decoupled PowerPoint solution where, you know, basically taking apart Google, let's put it that way, or taking apart Office 365. Now I think I almost feel like what we're doing, and maybe even embedded finance to an extent, is taking apart what SAP or Salesforce or whatever have been building up, and now making domain vertical excellence driven quasi players. I think that's what you guys are very much doing in comparison to the banks.
Right? This could also be the big next new thing, a kind of, let's say, modern SAP.
Yeah? Sure. That's what I see.
This would be, I mean, I would love this.
I think they're ripe for disruption. I mean, these are 40-year-old companies, 50-year-old companies soon. We all still, you know, we're old enough to still think of SAP as kind of like a newer company, right? But, I think if you look at someone who's, you know, 20, 25 years old coming into the world, they probably will never even sit in front of an SAP system if they're working in the startup world, right? So
it's true.
Let me ask something. We're almost out of time, and I want to be respectful of your time. Taking a little bit of a different switch, one of the things I always kind of see you popping up on is kind of women in fintech. I'm pretty sure that you're oftentimes invited to panels. What's your kind of take on that? Are we getting better in this kind of startup fintech world? Are more women coming into the industry? I mean, it's something that we also look at Receive in terms of trying to have a balance in the management of also female executives. What's your kind of take there? Where are we in Germany? Where are we in Europe in this fintech vertical?
I think, to be honest, I think it has not. It's not that I see much more women now. I don't see more women. What has happened in the last couple of years, which is good, that the ones that are there are more visible, because this is now, also at payment and banking, where we have these, let's say, exchanges for banking and payment and so on. We really, really try hard to make women visible in the industry. Yeah? At payment and banking, there's this regular column where we show women working, which women are in the industry on the panels. we try to have them equally, let's say, with men and women. And but still, I think if you look at the, let's say, C-level fintechs, there are not many women. Yeah. I mean, Bitwala now,
especially in Germany, it seemed like there was a, like maybe a year or two ago, it seemed like there was a couple of companies that were women-led, and they disappeared. And I'm kind of wondering whether there's kind of a retrenchment. Is quasi the COVID situation? Obviously, a lot of women have it so much harder if they have a family at home, especially if they have children. Mm. Do you think there's going to be kind of a retrenchment, or is there things that can be done to make it better? What do you think?
I think the only things that need to be done, actually, you have to set yourself a kind of, let's say, quota in order to change something. Because I think as soon as you have one woman in the board, you will have more women in the company.
Sure.
This is I was always against the quota, but I think it will not really change if this is not an active decision. And it is just, I see for example, at RatePay, RatePay is an exception. It's almost too many women in the board. So this is something that's the other way around. But I would love to have, let's say, a setup where you have half men, half women, and half, not only men and women, also much diverser. Yeah,
It is in general.
I think we see, let's say, most of the C-levels in fintechs are white males. And this is probably... I don't know, at least 90% probably. And this has to change.
Yeah, I mean, it's a mindset, right? I mean, we were talking about this diversity perspective, even with our company. I mean, we're an English first business. We don't require people to know German. And you can't imagine how many people we have that apply for jobs with us who say, look, I applied to a ton of other companies and they require German. So right there already, you already have a hurdle that is ridiculous.
Yeah.
Do business in English. I mean, your customers are going to be speaking English.
But I see it. I mean, with my co-founders at Banksware, they're all men.
Sure.
You know, when they hire, I mean, it's also, you know, they wrote this job profile now lately. Actually, I saw one that said, hey, we have to rewrite this. This is not attracting.
Not attractive.
It doesn't attract a woman. So actually, and I started hiring now some talent, and I have now two women around me. You know, they also take care now on how we do the job, how we do the job profiles and things like this. And I think this is super important. You have to start with one, but it needs, and I'm quite sure that it should be in a C level, because otherwise, you need to get more visibility to this.
Sure.
And this is, it is probably, the search is more difficult, but you will find them. Yeah?
It's tough. I mean, we have at Receive now, my head of marketing is a woman, my head of finance is a woman. We have a quasi more senior salesperson, and we did by design try and search out for women executives. We almost had a head of engineering, a woman, which I was shocked. I mean, it didn't work out, unfortunately, for other reasons. But I would have loved to have had that split, because then we would have had quasi a good balance.
Yeah.
But as you said, it's also very difficult to actually find the candidates, even if you're looking for them proactively, unless you then write the proper job descriptions and things like that to attract the best, right? I mean,
yeah, sometimes the job description, sometimes small things. And if you, for example, see only pictures of a company where there's only like the male founders, I mean, it's sometimes not so attractive and also for a woman to work there. Yeah.
Last question or last thing, I'll have a last question to finish this up, but one thing, everything's gone remote. Are you guys building Banksware completely remote, or how are you guys building the business?
Yeah, so more or less, yeah. So actually, there are some employees we have now I've never seen. So we have our office in Mitte, but it is a rather smaller office. So
is
we
Jens
cannot
in
put
Berlin
some...
now?
Yeah, he's in Berlin now.
Okay.
Yeah, he has an apartment in Munich where he lives sometimes, but the most, I would say 90% of the time, he is in Berlin. Mm-hmm. And so at the office at the moment, we have more our, let's say, younger people at the office that don't have a good, let's say, those people that don't have enough space to work at home. Sure. So we try to do something that where everybody has one room, so that there is really enough space. But most of the people are working, at home.
Yeah. And what's your take on that going forward? I mean, my gut says that here in Germany, for example, we're still not out of the woods for at least another month or two at a bare minimum. And my theory is that, you know, things are going to start opening up towards the end of the year. I don't see myself speaking at a conference anytime soon, or even attending a conference in person, maybe until the fall. Even I'm now concerned about things that were scheduled for the fall, whether they're going to happen.
Or
What's I mean, there? I mean, are we going to be out of this, and are people going to be going back to the offices anytime soon?
I think it will start a little bit smoother. I now have some invitations. I'm attending a very small conference in June, very small, and with testing.
Oh, wow.
Okay. And I see that there are some concepts now where people start opening up a bit, where they have hybrid formats. Yeah. Sure. And, okay, I got my first vaccination yesterday. Yes.
Oh,
so in June, I will have the second. And then I also, you know, as soon as I'm vaccinated, I'm quite happy to leave this home office again. I don't want to stay here forever.
You're gone, right?
Yeah. Oh, no, this is the... No, but I mean, it will change. We will have a change in our working behavior, I think. So we will... let's say post-corona, I think there is a form where we do work at home and we work in the office. Sure. Maybe we don't travel that much anymore, but we will travel again and we will go to conference. You see these pictures from Liverpool, you know, people dancing.
Yeah,
I mean, everybody was like, I would like to do that too. You know, people are waiting. So maybe this is even getting so after the post-corona, it's probably people are going more out, even more conference.
Yeah, no, here's my theory. So I think the conferences, and I'm even thinking we should actually do something. We might even do something along these lines. But if one of my favorite events or the concept of an event was something that a US VC did. He calls it Lobby. The actual event is called The Lobby. And as you know and I know, you actually meet all the people in the lobby or walking around between sessions.
Yeah.
And my thought process is that with all of us not having seen each other for so long and not having done things in person, if anyone actually sets up a conference that gets 500 or 1,000 people there who kind of all know each other from the industry, no one's going to go into the sessions. Everyone's just going to be catching up in the lobbies, talking to each other. So the best conferences will have no sessions. It'll just be kind of like an all-day party pretty much.
Yeah, it's just, the people have to, they're really missing this. And I see this especially payment and banking conferences. Sure. Yeah, because... Sure. I mean, this was always like this. This was so much networking, and it was always the after evening party, and so that brought the people together. And everybody is missing this so much. And
I feel like I've done like 90% of my deals over the last 20 years was at the
party. So this has changed a lot. Also, building up a business, completely remote. Yeah, we do that completely remote, always on Zoom calls, Teams calls, and. Hopefully, and also we won our first customers remote. So hopefully after, you know, when we can go out again, we win much more customers. But
the speed is going to change, right? Because then if you have to travel somewhere to get a customer and actually go there, I have customers all throughout Europe who I've never seen in person. And the fact that I didn't have to fly to Spain or fly to Stockholm or fly to Prague or wherever saved me so much time, right? And
Absolutely. I mean, Corona is actually good for the startup phase of a company because you can work. So, I mean, you know, then you have this meeting with somebody in London and you have to meet it. Then you are on a panel. Then you are in a meeting with an employee. Then you are in a meeting with your colleagues. Then you are in a meeting with two new customers. You can do this all in one day. I mean, imagine this during a normal week. It's not possible.
Yeah.
So, but still, I'm really looking forward. And I think that probably we will see some kind of normal things in fall, I would say, after the summer. Yeah, this is going to open up.
Last question, Miriam, because I want to let you get out of here on time. If you weren't doing what you were doing now, I mean, this is becoming my new question. What would you be doing otherwise? Would you be in the travel industry, or if you weren't in payment, what's your dream?
I have my dream job. Maybe. The only thing is that I might build up a new startup for digital education. Yeah, this would be also something that I was also thinking of. This is also I would like this, but also I love to travel. Maybe I do. Yeah, don't know. It's difficult for me because I cannot really. I'm super happy with what I'm doing, and
cool.
But good maybe building up something for digital education. Yeah. Could be also
Once you have your spectacular exit at Banksware, then you'll have time to go dabble in education. All right, Miriam, thank you so much.
Thank you very much. It's very nice.
Great to have you here, and all the best with Banksware.
Thank you. All the best for you as well. And I'm glad that we work together now. Great partnership.
Making announcements hopefully soon.
Yes.
Thanks again.
Thank you. Bye, Paul.